Welcome to this lecture by Professor William Sullivan. My name is Jens Christian Smeby, and on behalf of the Center for the Study of Professions and Program for Fremragende Professionskvalifisering, we organize this lecture. Bill is a senior scholar at the New American Colleges and University and also an adjunct professor at the Center for the Study of Professions. Many of you will also know him from his work by the Carnegie Foundation and, of course, from his previous visits here at the University College. Bill is an author of an extensive number of publications on the quality and development of professional education. Is well known for his concepts on the three apprenticeships. The lecture today is based on his new book, The Power of Integrated Learning. So Bill, the floor is yours. Yeah.
Thank you, Professor Smeby. And let me say that if my voice sounds not so great, it's all due to Oslo. Actually, it's not all due to Oslo. I'm not sure entirely where this all began, but on the plane coming from the U.S., I suddenly realized I was getting sick. So I'm now recovering, and I don't think I'm at all contagious. But if at various points I start to cough, you'll understand it's just because of that. So what I'd like to do this afternoon is to use the time, really, to try to launch us into what I hope will be an enlightening or interesting discussion about what is meant by this idea of integrating undergraduate experience in undergraduate learning. And I want to do this in reference to the book that Jens Christian just referred to, and you'll soon have a handout that will not only describe the book for you, but will also give you the opportunity to buy the book. Should you wish to do so. Unfortunately, it's denominated in euros, but it was the best that I could get the publisher to do on short notice. They didn't simply have a NOK version to slide in. And this was a study that I carried out over the last several years at the behest of an organization called the New American Colleges and Universities. And I'll be referring to that a number of times this afternoon. Their acronym is NACU, or NACU. There's no elegant way to say that. But it's a very interesting model, I think, of how undergraduate education can be organized, which is why I thought it was worth actually turning this work into a small book. And what I want to do this afternoon is to talk a little bit, just to set the context of where this organization has come from and what its goals are, and then to spend the rest of the time talking about the background for this in the American context, followed by some examples of this, taking the examples directly from the book, and then asking the question, what might be learned from the experiences of the New American Colleges and Universities? So nothing very dramatic, all pretty straightforward as a way to frame the discussion. What I'd like to do to begin is simply to explain where this organization came from. And it has a somewhat interesting history. It's about 25 years old, and it was founded at a conference in the U.S. in 1995. The convener of that conference was a person then prominent in American higher education circles named Ernest Boyer, who was the then president of the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching. And at this conference, Boyer and a number of other leaders in higher education at the time argued that it was important for the future of higher education in America that there be an organization that would explicitly attempt to reclaim what Boyer formulated as the distinctively American idea of higher education. So this, of course, is what will be one of the issues, I'm sure, during the rest of our time together, namely, to what degree does this translate into the Norwegian context? Are there elements of this which might be of value in the Norwegian context? In other words, what can be learned from this approach? And just a few words from Ernest Boyer that I think are helpful in trying to set this context. The way that Boyer formulated was to say that whereas in continental Europe, the tradition of higher education has centered on the university and with its very specific division into disciplines, formulated most famously, of course, by the Germans in the early 19th century. And whereas in Great Britain, higher education had concentrated on the college, so Oxford and Cambridge, the ancient universities, are actually collections of colleges in which masters and students live, eat, and study together, that the American distinctiveness was really a kind of blend that was neither the one nor the other. And he argued that it really was about three things. What he called the purposeful integration of liberal education, about which more in a few moments, professional studies, and civic engagement. So this mission, he argued, is a demanding one, and that was one of the reasons that Boyer thought it was time in the 1990s to resuscitate this ideal, because it was in danger of being pulled apart by the centrifugal force of the move towards specialization that was true at all levels of American society, but he thought particularly evident in colleges and universities. And so as Boyer described it, he said that the purpose of this organization will be to integrate all parts of campus life, recruitment, orientation, curriculum, teaching, residence halls, and the rest, so that they relate to one another and contribute to a sense of wholeness. So notice Boyer at the very early statement talks about some notion of wholeness. Boyer singled out the idea of community to describe this aim. We emphasize, he wrote, this commitment to community, not out of a sentimental attachment to tradition, but because our democratic way of life and perhaps our survival as a people rest on whether we can move beyond self-interest and begin to understand better the realities of our dependence on each other. So since that time, 25 colleges and universities have continued to develop this vision, sometimes referred to actually as the Boyer vision, of this threefold integration of professional studies, liberal arts, and civic engagement. And that's essentially what I want to talk about this afternoon. So here is the book, or rather, here is a flyer describing the book that will also describe how you can get the book. Pass those around. And I think there are plenty of these, so up here. So I thought it might be useful to begin this afternoon by asking you not to order the book at this moment, but to think for just a couple of minutes, assuming that you're sympathetic to this idea of somehow integrating undergrad education, to think for a couple of minutes about an example, an instance of what you see as integrated education. So if you could give a couple of minutes thought to that, and perhaps jot down a sentence or so setting that out. Now, this needn't be a very dramatic example, but if you would, I'd like you now to, as they say, talk to your neighbor about this and see what your neighbor has provided as an example. In this case, you may choose your neighbor. So, could I ask for a volunteer? And you don't have to volunteer yourself. You could volunteer your neighbor. An interesting example. No one wants to volunteer a neighbor? Okay. Please.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Yes, I thought about our students at the BBA in social work. In the fifth week they are at the college, they are asked, I work with the so-called problem-based learning. So they have our given a theme, which is poverty and
Social inequality.
Equality in Oslo, and they are asked to go out in the field to talk to somebody about this, or even or can find some theory or an article to illuminate what this is about. And
okay.
Then they should present, they should write a small essay, and then they present in a big group in on Friday. So I start on Monday and end up on Friday.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you. So if I understand it rightly, this is final year. These are social work students?
The first year.
First year social work students, right, who receive an assignment on Monday, mm-hmm. in this case dealing with social inequality, mm-hmm. right, and then have to actually go out into the field mm-hmm. to gather data, is this including
yeah.
talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
Do you specify who they're to talk to?
That could be organizations or professionals or... they have to be careful to talk with clients, but if they meet some, they meet somebody who sell a magazine in the street called Ali Fushko. They often talk to people like that, but they are not allowed to go into a social services and talk with clients.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. And then they produce a paper
mm-hmm.
By the end of the week.
Yeah.
On this topic.
They present what they found out also to the other students.
To their class.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. Another example? Interesting example?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I have engineering students. And the final assignment I have, really like that they go out to industry and work on projects that are relevant for society. So and they, it makes them very motivated. So they, I wouldn't call it necessarily civic work, but they do something. They definitely enjoy doing something that's just good for, you know, like improving architecture in Norway or something. Yeah. And sometimes students have attended. It's kind of like nothing to do with the high school, but there's engineering students can like go to Africa and work on projects related to like building water pumps and I think you know, charity work. That's definitely very civic and uses what they worked in for a school.
So in this case, the engineering students are in their final year?
Yeah.
And and this is a required part of their their degree?
Well, the ones that went to Africa, it's their choice, and usually it's a really bad time because they miss a term, a semester of teaching. But the final year project, that's like a formalized kind of thing.
Okay. And so again, it's some sort of actual involvement in the world, which interesting. Okay, and I suspect that a number of you had things like that, let's say, which had some sort of a focus on putting knowledge into practice or engaging with the world through the ideas or concepts of the fields. And these, as you'll see in just a minute, are very close to the kinds of things that the New American Colleges and universities have tried to promote over the years. What I'd like to do to open it up a bit is to put the development of the new American colleges and universities within a somewhat larger context in the U.S. And again, here you'll, I think, have to give me some indulgence in presenting this very American-centric kind of view, simply because this is, after all, an American case. But also in doing that, I'm hoping to be able to establish some resonance with discussions here as well. And to put it in the simplest terms I can, the debates in the U.S. about higher education, which have been fairly intensive and important really now for the last quarter century, so about the same length of time that the New American Colleges and Universities has been in existence, have really broken down into three agendas. And the three agendas, I think, are very simple, and most people recognize them pretty quickly. The first one that receives the most attention, certainly in the media, and is usually advocated by various government officials, by industry leaders, including by the President of the United States, is workforce development. Right? That in a highly competitive global economy, we have to develop a smarter, more efficient workforce. And that's what higher education is for. Now, from that, of course, different things follow and don't follow, though that doesn't in itself tell you what has to be part of higher education and what isn't going to be part of it. But in the American context, this has, on the whole, become understood to mean that things particularly like the traditional arts and sciences, unless they are somehow directly relevant or directly connected to enhancing workforce skills, are really of not much value. And this has been a particular problem for disciplines such as the humanities and areas of the social sciences as well. To some degree, it also has affected the funding of basic research in the sciences and so on. So that's the one, in many ways, the first, and in many ways, the triumphant contemporary agenda for higher education. There's a lot of pushback to that, however, and the pushback from within the academy, from within higher education, has largely taken the form of what I've referred to as the agenda of critical thinking. In other words, saying, well, it's not enough to simply have a smart, efficient workforce. We also have to train people to be able to think critically. They have to be able to understand the world, how things work, and to be able to make incisive judgments about that. And if you were to take a poll, as people have, on American university and college campuses, you would find out that, particularly among the faculty, the majority of the faculty would side with that. They would not actually adopt or would not promote the workforce development agenda. The majority of students, however, to say nothing of students' parents, subscribe to the first agenda, thereby setting up a certain conflict in the views of students and faculty, between the views of students and faculty. However, I want to argue that there is a third agenda, and the New American Colleges and Universities represent that agenda, that traditionally has been called the liberal arts. And this, I know, is a term that is very specific to the American milieu, and very, until fairly recently, actually, very little used in Europe. But the liberal arts in America, again, has its own distinctive implications and connotations. So it means something equivalent or roughly like Bildung in German. However, unlike the German Bildung, which has over time at least come to mean, come to place its greatest emphasis on culture and education in that sense, the American version of Bildung, the American liberal arts, has always emphasized this kind of more outgoing civic democratic role, which I think simply is a description of American national culture as contrasted with traditional German culture. So the liberal arts in that sense is and draws certainly inspiration from European notions of Bildung and the development of the personality and so on, but has also infused that with a more activist and politically, socially oriented kind of understanding. So that's the way I want to propose thinking about this kind of integrated education, that it's fundamentally an education which tries to acknowledge all three of those. In other words, which acknowledges the importance of workforce development, what in the New American Colleges and Universities language would be considered professional preparation. It also emphasizes or also acknowledges the importance of critical thinking, and certainly that's very much part of a liberal arts idea. But it also adds this notion of civic orientation or civic commitment, which is, I think, the distinctively American kind of college. So the New American Colleges, as it was originally called by Lewis Ernest Boyer in 1995, was a very deliberate effort then to kind of brand or to create a brand which brought together those ideas. So what does it look like in practice? It looks a lot like, at least many of the examples that I found, at least in studying the New American Colleges and Universities, the examples that you've already given. So let me just cite a couple of them to give you some feel for this. And then I think it would be appropriate if people want to raise questions or ask for any clarification to do so. To cite one example, there's a private university in Indiana, not that far actually from Chicago, called Valparaiso. Again, these strange American perversities of turning other languages into English. So Valparaiso actually becomes Valparaiso in the U.S., just as Detroit becomes Detroit, and so on and so forth. So at Valparaiso, there is an important major, not a huge major, but a very distinctive major field in meteorology. And the meteorology students in their final year have to take a field experience. And the field experience, remember where they are, they're in the American Midwest, which would be something like being in Ukraine, I mean, in a broad kind of plain. The high point of their field experience is what the students refer to as storm chasing. And what they're following and looking at is tornadoes. So during the field experience, that is storm chases, the participants apply the results of their courses in the science of meteorology. So they have taken courses about atmospheric dynamics, synoptics, mesoscale meteorology, and thermodynamics. But they apply these to the complex tasks of forecasting and tracking real-time severe weather on the Great Plains of North America. The inherent technical complexity of weather forecasting in a region known for its volatile conditions presents a demanding problem in itself. It really is where the rubber meets the road, a senior student declared. But this is a challenge the students are well prepared for, because during their field experience, they augment three-dimensional analytic and forecasting of atmospheric motions with strong communication skills to effectively track the severe weather systems and warn communities in their path. There is no little room for error or for miscommunication, because human lives are at stake. So for 80% of Valparaiso University meteorology students who participate, this field experience serves as a pivotal link between classroom theory and real-world application. That is, 80% of the students single out this experience. First-time participants, typically sophomores, enter this course with a solid foundation of analysis and forecasting. They also know physical principles of atmospheric motion and so forth. But veteran participants have acquired a much deeper understanding of the linkages between theoretical principles and the severe weather conditions they encounter. Early morning weather discussions provide students with the opportunity not only to explore the atmosphere and the depth of their knowledge, but also to develop liberal learning concepts such as leadership, mentoring, and skills in communication. So it's these field experiences then in this meteorology program which the students themselves credit as crucial for enabling them to move from being students of meteorology to coming to experience themselves as meteorologists. And in particular, it's significant that the students cite their sudden awareness that the decisions they make, because the decisions they make in this case really are how they will forecast what they predict is going to happen, could well mean the difference between survival and death for communities in the path of those storms. The result of this, then, is that such experiences change the students' view both of the world and of themselves. As a recent meteorology graduate noted, I was extremely proud to be a Valparaiso alum. Our faculty made sure that we developed our professional skills with opportunities for research, but we were also given the opportunity to be forecasters. No other school graduates had the same repertoire as I did. So that, I think, is a particularly salient example, if for no other reason, because chasing tornadoes is a fairly exciting, to say nothing of scary, business. But I think it also exemplifies something that's far more common among these institutions, which is a willingness for particularly faculty to move outside of their more conventional roles and to form relationships and bonds with those who will also function as mentors and teachers for the students. In this case, it's the actual National Weather Service personnel that the students will actually be working for and with when they're chasing the storms. Another example, which is much more conventional in its form, in that it takes place in the first year of a undergraduate program at Wagner College, which is an institution in New York City in Staten Island, which is that one borough of New York that people usually forget that sits south and west of the city. And Wagner College has a unique system, a unique curriculum, which they refer to as the practical liberal arts. And their effort really was to embody this Ernest Boyer ideal of the new American colleges as closely as they could. And just one word about the structure of it, because I think it's significant, is that they have spent some decade now developing a system by which every year, for 4 years, students take a series of courses that are referred to as communities of learning. And those consist of two subject matter courses, which are linked or related around a theme, which are connected by a course that teaches writing. So the writing course, which they call a reflective tutorial, uses the knowledge and activities of these two subject matter courses as its subject matter. So the students are learning to write and to think in ways that connect to academic disciplines. So, to give an example of this, one of the first year learning communities, and students can select the particular learning community, they all must take one during their first year, is called Living on Spaceship Earth. And students face then the big question, given how tightly living things and technologies are interconnected, how is it possible to sustain economic vitality and a positive environment for the complex web of living things? To understand this question, they study biology, learning about the world of organisms and their environments, and they also study economics, where they discover and learn to use intellectual tools for analyzing how businesses, jobs, and incomes connect with each other. So in Living on Spaceship Earth, the biology course is taught by one professor, while the economics course is taught by a peer professor in the economics faculty. The tutorial provides a connecting, continuing instruction and practice with the skills of written and oral communication, using the questions introduced throughout the activities of the learning community as a common theme. But they add to this the interesting requirement of a field component. And this sounds like the social work example, or perhaps the engineering example, putting it into a different register. And the component here is a real problem in a nearby community called Toms River, New Jersey. And for 5 consecutive Fridays, all 28 students and both professors spend a full day in Toms River. This town has abnormal levels of adolescent and childhood cancers, thought to be the result of chemical dumping in a nearby landfill. So under present law, the dumping is entirely legal. On those Friday visits, students and faculty meet with the families affected, with elected officials, with local media, and then with state and federal environmental protection agency officials, both in New Jersey and in Manhattan, to understand the various dimensions of the problems. They attend town meetings to learn how citizens are thinking about responding to it. Throughout all this, their assignment is to do serious research toward answering perplexing and important questions. And these are questions that are of vital concern to the residents of Toms River, such as, how would a scientifically trained investigator know if the elevated rates of cancer are traceable to chemical dumping? Another one, how would a social scientist determine the economic impact of these events on the community of Toms River? To complete these demanding assignments, the students, guided by their professors, write research papers on specific aspects of these issues. And in the process, they discover through their own experience what they need to learn, as well as the intellectual and communicative skills they must develop to figure out the situation and to work with others to resolve the problems. So what's, I think, very noteworthy about this, that typifies something else about what integration means in this kind of education, is that the problem which students are presented with is fundamentally an unscripted problem. That is, unlike most assignments in which students are told precisely what the problems are, and then their task is to figure out what the proper approach is and then to carry it out. In this case, students are not told in detail what the problem is, aside from the fact that there is this real difficulty confronting the inhabitants of Toms River. that a big part of the students' learning is to their own discovery of what the problems are in detail, such as those questions that I've already given, like, how would you know that it's these problems, these cancers, are related to chemical dumping? Or how far, in fact, are the environmental costs worth paying? So those examples, I hope anyway, give you some notion of what is meant by this kind of integrated learning. And one of its most conspicuous features, I think, and this is something that occurred in student interviews and student responses around these issues again and again, was the unscripted nature of the problems and the importance of what some of the faculty referred to as providing students with scaffolds by which they could come to grapple with these unscripted problems. So that, I think, is a fair summary of at least one of the important features of this kind of integrated education. What I'd like to do now is to ask you to pass these sheets around. And you realize when you look at this that what I'm actually doing is giving you a very abbreviated view of the book itself. Now, what these are really two excerpts from the book. 1, 2, 3, and 4, at the top of the page, are the elements of what I'm referring to in the book as the New American Colleges and Universities model of what you need to have an integrated education. The second selection, conclusion, learning that sticks, is a summary of a theory, or really a compilation of theories, of what effective learning actually must consist in. So what I'd like you to do is to take just a couple of minutes and read through these. Thank you. So this is the point where I would really like your input in thinking of this session as extending my own understanding of this kind of education. And that is taking those four elements or features of the New American Colleges and Universities model, which of those, if any, do you think are applicable to University College Oslo? That really isn't asking, is it fully realized, since it's not fully realized at any of the New American Colleges and Universities campuses, but rather, does this fit the Norwegian context or not? What do you think? Would anyone hazard a guess about a guess, an opinion about this? Number one.
It is a bit hard to understand the four points and distinctions. Maybe it would be helpful if you clarified it.
Okay. Yeah. To clarify, I mean, how they differ?
Yeah.
Okay, yes, thank you. Well, the effort here is to say that the courses of study, the curriculum, include elements that directly and consciously try to integrate liberal arts, professional competence, and the sense of responsibility, civically understood. The examples that I gave would be instances of that. Right. The second part, the second part of the model, has to do with the pedagogy. In other words, you can subscribe to that set of ideas, but in fact not have ways of making that happen for students. So here it's described as in using practices of teaching and learning to engage and promote student learning through employment of what are referred to as high-impact practices tested by research. And there's a literature around this that emphasizes, actually, again, the sorts of things which people have already suggested as examples. So pedagogies that have students apply ideas, not simply restate them. Capstone experiences that require students to bring together elements of their learning. Seminars and small group activities. Independent student research would be yet another. And there are a whole set of these. So the model would require not only that you have curricula that consciously think about these three things, but also that you have pedagogies that can be shown enable students to connect those things. Then the third part of the model, campus community climate, characterized by inclusive yet demanding expectations shared among students and faculty that support healthy relationships and personal growth. This is another feature that I haven't really spent any time on this afternoon of the New American Colleges and Universities idea, and that comes out of Ernest Boyer's emphasis upon community as being very important for learning. So what that means, at least in part, would be something which is a very big discussion in the U.S. and I would suspect is also discussed here as well, namely that there's a lot of evidence that for very large numbers of students, if not a majority of students, their educational involvement is not very involving. In other words, what's referred to as student disengagement. That students are often relatively indifferent to what they're actually supposed to be learning. And this has been a widespread problem in the U.S. for quite a while, and has given rise to a lot of anguish and wringing of hands and woeing and so on. But the answer to it turns out to be that a great number of the activities that students are involved in, they do not find engaging or of interest. And that's leaving aside the question of whose fault that is. So this feature, this third point, really is to say that that's not simply a result or not simply a function of what goes on in a classroom. It actually has to do with the overall atmosphere or climate of the campus itself. That there are campus climates, as it's sometimes described, in which there are strong norms of academic learning, that's seen as something which you're here to do and which is really a good thing and you ought to be doing, versus academic climates which are much looser in that regard, in which there's very little such informal norms. And then the fourth part of the model, cultivation of relationships between campus and the larger community and world to support educational experiences that enhance students' professional and career development as well as their commitment to civic partnership and service to the world. This really is very similar to number three, except it takes it further. That it's the argument here is that students become members of the social world of their campus to a significant degree. And if that social world is built around norms which propel students to think it's natural to wonder about how they're supposed to use these things or to feel that they are called upon to use their knowledge in some way of improving or enhancing the world, that will be quite different. Student experience will be quite different from their experience on a campus that lacks that kind of orientation. Is that a bit helpful? So this was my distillation, really, of what they tried to do. And actually, in a number of cases, were remarkably successful at doing that, it seemed. But it turned out that was not an accident when it happened, that there was a huge amount of intentional organization with a good deal, it looked like, of trial and error, correction of course, to make some of that actually happen. But does that sound like a reasonable goal for Norwegian higher education?
At least for my institute, my department,
yeah.
I see that what we aspire to is very much in line with points 2 to 4. Four, because we try to motivate our students to join professional body because they'll be engineers, they're joining this body anyway, so they can join as student members and they can go to start networking with industry before they've finished. So it's kind of like an external activity. But the point one, this civic thing, is we don't have any of it, and apart from in projects, but it's not really, I would call it really very philanthropic, you know, it's things to do with industry. But I think this is a national thing, because the national body that kind of dictates how what we have in our curriculum, that Lockwood, basically they tell all the universities and colleges in Old Norway what we should aspire to put in our curriculum, and there's no such thing as there's no impetus for us to have any kind of civic activities. It's not there. But maybe we should maybe aspire to do that, because we can see that it would give our students more character and maybe more engagement.
But interesting.
Maybe Lockwood should attend this lecture.
Does that seem generally right to people? Yes.
Yeah. In Norway we have this work that's called dugnad. It means volunteer work, and it's there's a difference, I think, between the United States and Norway in that here volunteer work is something. It's not the responsibility of the school to tell you to do volunteer work. It's something that you brought up with, sort of, and you do it in your neighborhood. For example, it's quite common. But I think also this is changing, because it's becoming maybe less and less common to take part in this dugnad now than it perhaps was before. So maybe we should have a discussion about it. But I think it's very cultural. I think it's the concept would be a bit hard to put into a curriculum, because it would feel like it doesn't belong there. Like this is something we should do outside of school, not as part of the education.
Interesting. Because, of course, this is all relatively new in the U.S., I mean, in the last 25 years, so roughly since the time of the foundation of this consortium, which is, I tried to explain earlier, was really founded in part to address that problem, or it was felt to be an increasing problem. And in the U.S. context, too, I'm not sure if this is true in Norway, but there was for a very long time at the secondary level a requirement for various kinds of civic education that were not so much about practice as they were, however, about knowledge. And some of them certainly had elements of practice. So there was what was referred to as Problems of Democracy, which was a course that every high school student had to take in their last year of high school, which was fundamentally a kind of, I guess it probably came out of the New Deal, something like that. And it was a look at what were the basic social problems of the United States and what were the histories of dealing with this. None of that seems to have survived the large political cultural explosions of the 1970s, 60s and 70s. Where it became much more controversial to suddenly talk about those things. So that it could be that these matters go up and down depending on the national political situation as well. But still, that's interesting, that it's much less controversial, certainly in the U.S., to argue that students should be encouraged to be engaged. And it would be not only sort of philanthropic service or local service as meant by civic engagement, but it would really also have to do with a notion of citizenship broadly understood as having some sense of collective responsibility, which Norway certainly far surpasses the U.S. on all international measures in that regard. So again, this is one of the interesting things about the translation or non-translation of various educational ideas from one society to another. Yes?
I think that's an interesting discussion because I read lots of your work previously, and this civic dimension, I always struggled a little bit about it. And I think in one way, we take it more or less for granted in one way. And then another problem, I think when you mentioned this problem, I would say that there is a danger that it was, it's considered as some kind of left-wing initiative, some radical critics of what's going on with industry, and of course try to balance this kind of consideration. Also, when you talk about the history, I wonder whether some of these memorials lead to Christianity. So, and that's not that much anymore, but so maybe we need some more conscious development of these kind of dimensions.
Yes.
Let's see, all the health and social educations in Norway, they will have a common part of the curriculum, which includes health and social politics and knowledge about how the state and the communities are run. So that is part of the education, part of the curriculum. And I thought that would sort of meet some of these things you are talking about now.
So you see a link to that, I think. But not, I think, in higher education as a whole.
It's
incorrect.
In all the bachelor degrees.
Oh, really?
It's sort of told us to put into the curriculum.
Oh.
And also how many credits.
Interesting.
But there is even ethics.
Yeah, that's it. And also how to work together, conflict solving, also this common part of the curriculum in all health and social and professional education.
So they're largely through the professional education sector. Okay. And that's one of again, I think that the difficulty that, at least in my mind, always trying to translate back and forth transatlantically, is the U.S. emphasis on the liberal arts, which is so strong, relatively speaking, even if in practice it isn't dramatically good, means that a number of these things fall in the U.S. context into somewhere in this liberal arts notion that here are more likely to be placed in professional training. And the professional parts in the U.S. often have to be augmented in that regard. So it's, I think, a somewhat different sense of those things. Yes?
I find this quite really interesting, the campus community climate, because I think from one to to a certain degree, you can do that in the classroom as a teacher, and you can work with that in different courses. But this, the third point, like moving forward together somehow. Could you talk some more about that third point and how you really make that?
And this is the campus climate you're talking about.
Yeah, that climate. How we do that together as a faculty or an institute?
Yeah, that's
community of teachers.
Yeah. No, I mean, obviously, that's an extremely difficult thing to do in practice. And this has become an issue in American higher education, and I think certainly for this consortium of institutions, it became an issue because of fears or worries that campus climate was deteriorating in important ways. Now, that's always a difficult thing to measure because the argument is always there that, well, what appeared to be a better campus climate was really because it was a more homogeneous and exclusionary campus climate. You can always get positive results if you exclude lots of people. So there are, in fact, you know, complicating factors here. And it's difficult, I think, to get a very simple, clear demarcation in that regard between what is and is not exclusionary and so on. But the way I understood the approach of many of these institutions was they put a lot of emphasis on these sorts of social service involvement in the local community themes in student life. And often this would be a significant part of their new student orientation, for example. So one of the instances in the book, which really surprised me, actually, it was one institution, Laverne University in Los Angeles, begins, their students begin by a day of service to the local community in which they meet faculty doing the same thing. And several students responded to this by saying that they never before had a chance to meet their faculty outside of class, right, before they met them in class. And this had a very large impact on them in terms of seeing the faculty as human beings with similar kinds of concerns. But what I take that to be a symptom of is a campus where the effort is really to lay out a set of common norms. And one of the features of those norms is that you should be concerned about, you should be interested in, you should make an effort to support the community around you. And so I think if you think of it that way, of in effect what social scientists, sociologists would do it, which is, you know, to get people together and ask them to say what are the things that people will look up to you for doing, what are the things that people are going to give you a lot of trouble if you do, that if you push that, you can find out what a community's actual values are and what it's doing. And a number of these institutions have really tried to move that way. Now, partly they did that for idealism, in the sense that the whole thing was based on a kind of idealistic vision. But the idealism also, these are Americans after all, also had a very pragmatic feature to it. That is, that if they can show that to prospective parents, that if you send your students, your children here, and pay all the money that you're going to have to pay. I remember in the U.S. this is a very expensive education. Then what we can guarantee you is they're going to be in a place where the expectations are that they're going to turn out to be responsible adults. And for a lot of parents, that is an attractive proposition. So they really did put resources and efforts into trying to figure out how to make that come about. I mean, these things are relatively successful. Of course, they're never totally successful. But I think that's a good question as to how to break these things down so they're simply not general abstractions, but actually you can identify that this is a case that, you know, it's operating here or it's not operating here. People take this seriously or they don't take it seriously. And then it turns out that the key to that is you've got to get the opinion leaders on your side, right? The people who are seen as, the people to look up to, the cool kids, the people who really are in the know. These are the people that you have to persuade a significant number of them that this is really the way to go, that this is actually the way it's going to be here. Yeah, good questions. I mean, this helps me understand your context better, as well as this. Let me conclude by turning to this last section, and this is not the conclusion of the book, it's actually a, just a chunk of a chapter. And I wanted to call your attention to this because I think it's a very striking formulation of what integrated learning means. And what makes it striking in part is that the authors in question, Richard Keeling and Richard Hirsch, summarize their idea of integrated learning not primarily by focusing on the elements of it, which is what I've done and what the New American Colleges and Universities do on the whole, but rather by focusing on the effects of it on students. So just take a look at that for a minute. Learning that sticks, as they put it, the kind that leads to the kind of changes we expect of college, what we call higher learning, requires rich engagement with new material. Right? So that is sort of straightforward. Prompted by a teaching, by teaching and a climate. So here's the climate issue again, the general norms in operation, that stimulates significant challenge and support. So that's a difficult balance. If any of you have experienced teaching, know this one. That how do you, at one and the same time, make it clear that you're not going to take nonsense, right? That you really are going to demand that a certain level of performance, and make it clear that you're willing to support people's efforts to do that, that you're most interested in that they learn it, they achieve it. Learning also depends on a deep engagement of emotional energy. So here we are, the student disengagement problem. If there's no deep emotional engagement, no learning is the claim that they're making. Deep engagement of imagination and perseverance, an old-time virtue. And then they say, this learning, so it's even more demanding, this learning is manifest in the ability to apply new knowledge to the world. So you haven't really learned much if you can't say anything or write anything or initiate anything of any value for the world. Articulate and defend a new perspective, so actually get some new ideas, and grow in personal, social, and civic maturity. They called the outcome of this kind of demanding process integrated learning. They concluded that this is the most valuable outcome of a college education, and so ought to be seen as its measure and goal. Now, they then point out, and their book has the rather challenging title of We're Losing Our Minds. And that, of course, is a pun. But they argue that virtually no institutions of higher education in the U.S. really do take this as their operational goal. As too often in higher education as a whole, they lament, it's not its actual measure and goal. But they argue it could be, and moreover, that it really should be. That the purpose of higher education, as they see it, is this kind of, if we could put it in a crude sort of economic kind of way, this kind of human upgrading. That it really is about people becoming better than they were when they began or when they entered. But this is a highly demanding and engaging activity. And as they argue, it's just much easier for university administrations, to say nothing of teachers and students, to just ignore all that and to get through with the least effort to do whatever you have to do to make it all possible to get out. So what I think is significant about the New American Colleges and Universities is not that they've in fact solved all of these problems, but that they have at least confronted them and articulated what they need to do. And I think that the value of what they've done is far beyond them, that I think it's of use or interest to the rest of us who are concerned about higher education, because it points toward what a genuine kind of higher education would actually be like, and does that in a way which enables us to identify the specific components. And of course, in a sort of engineering sense, if you can identify the components and the goals of the components, you have a much better shot at actually improving their performance. So that's how I at least would like to see this little book, as a kind of way to begin to push a discussion about higher education in that sort of a way, and to that end. So I think we're on time. And actually, there's a moment for any concluding observation. You can tell me you thought this was really not so great, but anything that anyone would like to dispute, or more importantly, I guess, really to add or to develop?
I think what's very powerful in this perspective is that it just doesn't add that we need more civic perspectives and so on, but you include all these kind of dimensions, which is important to improve all different kinds of learning. And it's about motivation and so on. Former colleague Harold Greenman talked about practical synthesis in professional education. It has to do making sense of all these different kinds. Want students to learn, and if students don't understand the meaning behind it, they doesn't learn either.
Yeah.
And that's why I think it's interesting that the title of the book is The Power of Integrated Learning, and not, for example, educational teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Student learning.
that's, I think, really important, actually, and I agree. And as you can see, I was very taken with that that quote from Keeling and Hirsch, because that's what they do, is to emphasize. I mean, what essentially, theirs is a rather small book as well, and what they do, this is We're Losing Our Minds, which came out in 2011, I think, so it's a pretty recent book. What they do is to say, well, there's been, you know, decades of research about learning and teaching and how it works and so on. What does it really come to? And then they lay out, basically, I've summarized it, but they lay out something like that, and in its somewhat greater length. And they make a couple of very interesting comments, because, as they point out, these are much harder to implement than you might think. And one of them had been a college president, so he knew a lot about what he was talking about. And that is that the process really is cumulative. So that means that you've got to keep it going. And as they put it, there's both a vertical dimension, that is to say, you're becoming more sophisticated in different fields. You're growing theoretical understanding and so on. But there's also an equally important horizontal dimension that connects, or has to connect, what you learn in the classroom, what you learn by yourself, what you learn from your peers, what you learn in social life, and so on. And that's what makes it such a grand enterprise. But as they also point out, we know very well, and everyone knows this from experience, I think, of knowing such people, but we also know it from other kinds of research, that what this can do for people is just dramatic. that people really often do come into their own as human beings through this kind of a educational experience. And I think what struck me about their book really was that it's pervaded by this sense that we could do much better at this, we know how to do much better at this, and it's really terrible that there's so much human waste that we're just not, in fact, somehow enabling students to get what they need or to really go through this process. And that's really what I think my hope anyway is that the example of these colleges and universities could help stimulate more interest in that as well.
Yeah, is there any data showing that colleges that have implemented this civic element that they have fewer dropouts? Because that has a very economic benefit to the college.
Yes.
Is there any data about that?
Yes, there is. And the data, well, basically the data says that pretty much anything you can do that builds the campus community, the sense of what we were talking about earlier, of engagement and sharing of common norms, keeps people there. So we operate with, in modern culture, I think, with two contradictory notions about human nature and human motivation. Unfortunately, both of which are probably true to some degree. And one of them, the more common one, is that people only do things because they have to. So you have to make them do them or you have to bribe them to do them. The other one is that people are, let's put it differently, people will do extraordinary things if they feel part of something that they think it's worth belonging to. And I think to a great degree, these places that when they've been successful, and most of them I think have been successful at this, it's because they've adopted that second strategy and really trying to make it happen. So yes, from the college's own point of view, from self-interested motives, they would like their students to be more engaged because it will, in fact, increase their loyalty to the institution. So, thank you very much, and my apologies for my voice. I mean, I know this probably has not been the most melodious sound to have to listen to, and I wish you well.
Thank you very much. I think you've demonstrated the importance of setting up these schools, and also that even though they are difficult to reach, I think it's highly important in these no-good times, as we often say, the accreditation to measure not especially these kinds of
things. Yeah. Okay.